The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing. Not because they are easy, but
we
because they are hard.
Start. 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting to 7 continents. Consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good afternoon. Good evening, everyone. Afternoon. It's so nice in California. I'm getting the times mixed up. Welcome to our Tuesday evening space show. I am your host, David Livingston. Thank you very much for tuning in this evening. Interesting discussion on export controls coming up, but first a couple of quick announcements. You can call and talk to our guest today, Dr. Eligar Sade. The toll-free number is 1-866-687-7223. Remember, no call screeners. Let the phone ring, and we'll bring you up on air as quickly as possible. You can also use email, drspace, D-R-S-P-A-C-E, at thespaceshow.com. That also happens to be our website, and there you will find our detailed comprehensive newsletter, which is updated on Sunday after our Sunday Space Show program. It has all of the information on the week's programming. It has the guest bio, and it's the only place where we have a future events section. All of our shows are archived on the website. Just scroll down and you'll see them. And you can easily download them or you can play them right off of our website. The same is true for our blog, thespaceshow.wordpress.com. And you can also exchange ideas and conversations and thoughts with other listeners on the blog, as well as many of the guests as they too participate in the comments on the blog. There is a store in the upper left-hand corner, Space Show Gear. Please do visit it. Check it out. The most important button there is the Support the Space Show button. Remember, we're a nonprofit 501c3 with onegiantleapfoundation.org. We exist because many of you do support us. We thank you very much for your support. Without your support, we would not be doing the Space Show. And remember, for those of you that pay U.S. federal taxes, as a 501c3, you do get a tax deduction for your gift. The same is true for those of you in California paying California taxes, as we are a California public benefit corporation. Please remember our shows are trademarked and copyrighted, but you do have permission to download them, share them, and pass them around on the net to people you think might be interested in listening to the shows or learning something about space. Please remember not to do anything commercial with the shows. No editing of any of the shows, and written transcripts are not permitted, even if they're for your own personal use. Podcasting is through the kind services of Andrew Grummet at gigadial.net. The RSS URL is on our website, and you can subscribe to our podcast that way. We're in iTunes and a host of other places. And if you have any questions about our podcast, don't hesitate to email me again at drspace@thespaceshow.com. Finally, do remember that we are brought to you in part by the Secure World Foundation. Secure World promotes cooperative solutions for space security, and you can get more information about them by visiting their website, www.swfound.org. And remember, they also are the sponsors of our webinar series. Our guest today is a longtime friend of mine, and he's been absent from the Space Show for a couple of years, Dr. Eligar Sade. And Dr. Sade is president and CEO of Astro Consulting International, LLC, which empowers space defense and environmental programs and projects with the critical skills to optimize outcomes. And he is also chief editor of the very academic and prestigious journal, Astropolitics. His full bio is on the website, so you can read about him. But he has been involved in export controls of late and knows what's happening with export controls, and I think that this will be our opportunity to get a really good export to really get a good update, on what's happening with ITAR and export controls. So, Eligar, welcome back to the Space Show. How have you been? And tell us what's happening with export controls. I hear the world is changing with them, right?
Oh, yes, very much so. Yeah, thanks for having me back on. It's good to be back with you here on the Space Show. Yeah, as you mentioned, I have been involved recently with some in-depth work on export controls specific to space technologies, space satellites more specifically. As probably many listeners know and people in the space community will know, this has been an ongoing issue for the space community. In fact, one of the top 10 probably policy legal issues that have been out there for many, many years. It's always made those lists. Going back about, 15, 16 years now, I guess in the late 1990s, in 1999, they passed the National Defense Authorization Act that basically treated all satellites, for the most part, as being of military use. And the problems that resulted there is that when you try to regulate and control all satellites and satellite components as being of military use, that can clearly posit an issue for the commercial satellite industry. And it has so very much. I mean, you mentioned, David, in the introduction, the ITAR regime, and this was the governing regime that was put into place at that time in 1999 to control all satellites, including all dual-use satellites, so that really entails all commercial satellites as well. The ITAR regime, again, is the International Traffic and Arms Regulation regime, and therein there's something called a U.S. munitions list. So the name there alone gives you the sense of how we treated satellite and satellite components. We treated them as we would regulate the export and controls of munitions themselves and armaments themselves. And this posed many, many problems, and it took many years for a resolution to finally come forward, which it has very, very recently. And I guess we can focus, a little on the history of where we've been and where we are today and where we're going to be going forward with the regime. But there were many, many problems. Primarily the problem is that it began to erode our industrial base and our global competitiveness and commercial satellite markets. And that was really the big issue. People began to realize, and there were a number of assessments made over the years that, and reports that were issued by government, including even DOD, Department of Defense, that we were harming our national security by undercutting our industrial base, making our industrial base less competitive and eroding lower tiers of our industrial base, particularly the satellite manufacturing companies, satellite component companies that were providing those, hardware and software systems to the large-scale integrators like, a Boeing or a Lockheed Martin as an example. And because we were eroding our industrial base, we're also harming that same industrial base that supports our national defense, national security systems, which are also very dependent on in many different ways on space systems.
Have you seen a reversal of any of this erosion with the changes that have happened so far, or is it too soon?
It's too soon to know at this point, but clearly there was a growing call from the government end, a growing call from the industry end that reform was needed. And basically what has occurred was a changeover where they pretty much took most of the satellite technologies components and started treating satellites that were of non-military use as commercial satellites. They put that within another export control regime that the U.S. has. We have kind of a bifurcated export control regime. We have on one hand the national security one that I talked about. The one that I didn't mention yet was the other export control regime that's governed by the Department of Commerce versus the Department of State, and this is the Export Administrative Regulations, known as EAR, and there they have what's called a Commerce Control List. So basically now Commerce, through that regime, is governing commercial satellites, and we're treating commercial satellites as commercial satellites under this new regime. So many feel, it's going to improve the situation. It will end the erosion of the industrial base. It'll enhance our global competitiveness. The business of space is very global today, as you well know, Dave, and probably many of your listeners know. So this is a regime that matches much better with clearly the dynamics of the space economy worldwide.
What does the military think of this in terms of national security issues? How did you address the national security issues, especially with dual-use stuff?
Well, that's a good question. You know, and then there were a lot of interagency discussions that, led to how we're going to go about implementing this regime. This new regime, by the way, began very, very recently, just with the 2013 National Defense Authorization Act, and it's only has been implemented since November of this past year. I mean, I became abreast of all the issues, having done some research work and consulting work in this specific area. But you're going specific to your question, David. That was something that there were very in-depth discussions between the Department of Defense and Department of Commerce, and it was clear that there was a shift in the mindset of defense. And this actually emerged a little earlier in 2012. There was a Department of Defense-led industrial assessment report that did an in-depth study of how you could go about reforming the export control regime. And the Department of Defense really came to the realization, you know, before this law was even passed, that we can control national security by targeting very, very specifically systems that are of national security use and targeting very, very specifically components that may harm a national security instead of having kind of a blanket-wide approach, an all-encompassing approach that kind of treated all systems, regardless of their use, as having a military purpose behind them. So defense basically took a very, very targeted approach, and you kind of have an approach now where everything is assumed to be of dual use or of a commercial use, and then defense looks at these systems and says, well, if there's a specific technology there, or if there's a specific military use of an entire system that has a very direct and clear military application, then that would still fall under the earlier regime of the ITAR regime and the U.S. munitions list regime.
So you have your first question is from our friend Todd in San Diego, and he says, Eligar, there is a plethora of small satellites and CubeSats that are showing up as launched satellites, even being thrown out of the ISS. So are these at all controlled items? What are the CubeSats classified as? Does anybody care about them?
Well, that has come up as an issue, and they're still discussing how to regulate that. I mean, right now, because of the class of those satellites, they don't fall directly under any control regime, per se, as systems. But there is discussions going on that we need to somehow address that issue. So that actually was something that was brought up, but it hasn't been resolved as of yet in terms of how we're going to treat that under this new regime, the small satellites and the small satellite market. You know, up until very recently, that market has been, that's been largely an educationally oriented one, but clearly that's beginning to change. There are some now commercial applications emerging and things of that nature, and clearly you could have military applications as well with small satellites. So there's still ongoing discussions. It's a very good question, but it's something that hasn't really been resolved yet at the level of the government in terms of its thinking, how it wants to apply export control rules to those particular systems.
So CubeSats, do people proceed as if they're a regulated, controlled item, or do they just cast their fate to the wind and not worry about it?
Well, at this point, you know, most of the liability under those falls with industry, with the actual developer of those systems, you know, whether it's industry or an educational entity, and they're kind of exempt per se from the rules, but at the same time they have to comply with the rules that are out there that make sure they don't violate national security. It's kind of a strange regime in that there's some uncertainty going on in regard to those systems, a little more uncertainty even with the commercial satellites. You know, under the new regime, even with larger scale commercial satellites, what's interesting about it is that basically the way the law is set up and the way the regulations are set up, industry has to assume now the liability of making sure they comply with the laws. And if they fail to comply, there could be obviously, you know, penalties on industry. So it's kind of an interesting regime. With the older regime, you had, you know, the regulation being imposed upon from the government, from the Department of Defense to industry, and now industry is kind of responsible. The rules are laid out, and now it's up to industry to figure out how do we make sure we comply with the rules. Small satellites are even further exempt at this point, but there's still the concern among those developers on a small satellite sector that they better be wary of what the rules are and try their best to comply. know, right now that hasn't been resolved. I mean, some of the problems we discovered is that this is kind of a new regime in the making. The transition is occurring as we're speaking. There are transitions issues, a lot of uncertainty issues regarding specific types of systems like small satellites. How can industry deal with the new burden of being liable versus the government being liable on their end? So there are a number of issues that are out there that really haven't been resolved as of yet. You know, people are still trying to figure out what's going to take place as we move forward and implement this new regime.
Ben in Boston sent in an email. Listeners, come on, this is nighttime. You can use the phone. You don't have to keep sending us email. 1-866-687-7223. It's much more interesting if you use the phone. Okay, Ben says the following. Can you tell us if the national security aspect of all of this is going to allow sharing with foreigners, or is that still prohibited even though this is going over to Department of Commerce? That is, can a company now talk about their technology with a commercial satellite with, say, an ally like Israel or the United Kingdom, or would that still be prohibited?
No, that is, in fact, allowed right now. I mean, as long as, you know, there are a few restrictions on that. There are some specific national security components that have a direct national security application that are still part of the older regime. So if you're talking specific to those components, you cannot. But outside of that, it's a very small list at this point. Outside of that, even if one of those components are integrated into a commercial system, once they're integrated, if you're just talking about the system itself, there are no national security restrictions on those discussions. So as long as you're not talking about one of those technologies specifically that are still controlled by USML, ITAR, there are no restrictions on that under the new regime. There even is, in fact, what's called a strategic trade authorization with a number of our countries, and this actually exempts exempts industry from having the need to obtain any license, any export license from the government. And this actually involves all our European allies and several other countries. You know, you could look it up online. I could go through the whole list. There's a whole list here. And there's some additional countries that also fall within similar guidelines, like Israel's on that list, for example. They fall under similar guidelines as strategic trade authorization states. So many of our allies and other countries we work very closely with are, in fact, exempt. You know, when we're doing export controls of either systems or components that are controlled now under commerce for commercial purposes, they're exempt from a license. However, this trade authorization is kind of a regime in and of itself, and companies are still have to demonstrate to government that there are no violations of national security, although they're exempt from getting that formal license, from having to go through that regulatory licensing process from government. So there's a, you know, big upside to it, obviously, but it doesn't mean we've, you know, made it all free or decontrolled. It just means we've shifted it to another type of regime that allows for a little more flexibility and a little more leeway, particularly when we're dealing with commercial satellites.
Was this bipartisan to do this, or was it lopsided in one side only?
No, this was very, very bipartisan. In fact, you know, some of the history of this began under the previous Bush administration. There were some executive directives directed at reforming and streamlining some of the regulatory processes under the older regime, and the Obama administration continued some of that and issued some directives as well. So you saw support from both, you know, the Republicans and the Democrats in Washington and in Congress as well, although there wasn't a majority in Congress to get official reform at the legal level. That only occurred in 2013, and many believe that only really took place when Department of Defense basically said in 2012, as I mentioned at the beginning, that the current laws are harming our national security. And once Congress heard that from the Department of Defense, Congress basically said, well, we need to reform this, and that took place by law a year later.
So is this fully operational now, or is it only sort of evolving into operation? I'm a little confused because you said it started up finally in the fall of 2014 last year, but is it now fully operational and this is the new regime?
Yes, well, this is the new regime. The final rules are in place, and you can, in fact, even download them. They're available online. You have the final rules issued by the Department of Commerce for export controls of you know, including satellite technologies, a certain category that deals with, you know, spacecraft systems. So these are the final rules. This is the new regime. However, we're still in a transition period, so we're transitioning out of the ITAR regime into this new regime. The rules are there. This is the new regime. So the answer to your question is yes on one hand, but no on the other hand, because we're still in a transition period with a great deal of uncertainty. Many of the experts who are dealing with this in Washington, the government folks who are dealing with this and industry folks, addressed a degree of concern in terms of legal uncertainties that still need to be resolved. Transaction costs, you know, how is industry going to bear the liability now? Because you have a shift of the liability regime from the government to industry. It is somewhat of a more regulatory process now, although it's freer in the sense of, you know, allowing, being more friendly to, you know, economic trade, export of technologies and things like that. So it's a friendlier regime in that regard, but there are administrative burdens that many are still concerned about, and what would be the cost to address those administrative burdens, and how would industry assume its liability and make sure it's not in violation of anything related to this regime or in violation of national security national security regulations.
So if we were to refer to ITAR, we would now be incorrect because ITAR is no longer in place. Is that a correct understanding?
Well, not completely. I mean, ITAR is still in place. What has occurred is that ITAR, you know, the intended purpose of ITAR was really to control from a national security standpoint, to control our exporting and to regulate at that level munitions and armaments. That's what ITAR was designed for. And then we put into ITAR as a result of the national security environment and a fallout with some transfer of sensitive technologies, particularly related to rockets and ballistic missiles to China. In the 1990s, we put into that regime spacecraft satellites and satellite components. So ITAR is still there. It's still there to regulate. What's changed in relationship to spacecraft systems is that we've taken out of ITAR most of these satellite components, and we've placed that now under the other regime. So ITAR is still there, regulating only very few targeted spacecraft components that may or may not go into commercial satellite systems. And ITAR, in the larger sense, is still there, you know, regulating and controlling, you know, the armaments and munitions. So that regime hasn't gone away. We've just shifted the majority of the satellite, you know, components over to the commerce control list and the regime under the Department of Commerce.
Karen is in Seattle and sent in an email and says, do you foresee this facilitating the growth of the emerging commercial space sector?
I think very much so. I mean, particularly, you know, I think it's clear to many that, you know, the business of space is global in nature, and there's a global dynamic to it. And I think many of the larger context behind all this is we had a regime that really was designed in the environment of the Cold War, where national security, you know, which always trump in all cases any concern about economic competitiveness or global markets or things like that. I think we've seen, you know, in general, that the space industry has moved to become a global wide industry, and there's many multinational partnerships. It can involve government, industry to industry, multinational relationships, clearly a need to have friendly export control regimes in place to allow for that industry to move forward. So I think clearly there's going to be a benefit to the commercial satellite industry directly, but I think there'll be a spillover into other sectors as well. You know, right now it's it's still hard to tell, you know, how international some of these entrepreneurial startups are going to become, you know, but clearly if we look at ones that have become quite sizable, you know, that started as, you know, smaller entrepreneurial startups, you know, you take a company like Space Exploration Technologies, a lot of their business is very international, and clearly this type of regime is going to allow them to be more competitive in that marketplace. So I think overall it's a movement in the right direction, and it's a recognition that, you know, the nature of what we do in space has a global dynamic to it. Now we have a regime that matches that reality much better.
SpaceX said a couple of weeks ago that they wanted to get into the satellite business, and they were going to open a Seattle office for that. Do you think that that's because of these changes, and it's made it a little bit easier for commercial companies to get into this and to have global markets?
Yeah, I would think in part. I mean, I don't know, you know, it's hard to get into the mind of the leadership there, but I would think in part, clearly that played a significant factor in that decision that was made by them. You know, I think today, you know, again, when you have a regime that is treating commercial satellites as an item of commerce, and you have an agency of government, the Department of Commerce, that looks at the regulation as a matter of enhancing our economic competitiveness, making sure we have a robust industrial base that can that basically is not going to be eroded. You know, making sure that our competitiveness in the commercial satellite markets are very robust and match the global realities out there. I think all that is going to encourage people to get into that line of business. So clearly, I think that plays a very significant, you know, role. It must have. You know, I can't know for sure, but I would think so.
Changing world, isn't it?
Yeah.
It should make it easier for the smaller companies. But did you have industry support, like the big satellite makers, Loral, Lockheed, Boeing, all of these, ATK, did they join in this? Were they supportive of these changes?
Oh, yeah, they were very supportive as well. You know, although, you know, when you're dealing with the larger scale systems integrators, the larger scale companies of what we would call the first tier of the industrial base, you know, clearly they could address the issues and the cost and still be quite profitable under the older regime, but they were on board with the changes as well. I mean, they were beginning to recognize that it was not useful for them as well in terms of their abilities to do things internationally, although the major economic issues dealt more with the lower tiers of the industrial base and the overall erosion of our global competitiveness. You know, there are other factors that came to light as well. I mean, what really began to occur as well in the last several years prior to this regime change is that we began to see that other our partners abroad were beginning to develop systems on their own without any U.S. parts, and that was a problem as well. I know probably many of your listeners are aware that Europe was beginning to develop what were called then ITAR-free satellites, you know, satellites free of any U.S. components, because it was very arduous for them to deal with the ITAR regime on the U.S. side, and then what harmed their abilities to develop their systems. So you began to see this trend of other countries and other industries abroad pursuing spacecraft systems without any U.S. input into those systems, and that was an additional issue that also came, you know, that basically also led people to realize that we need a change in this regime.
Yeah, I know that there was a big market in the anti-ITAR satellites coming from other countries to compete where the Americans could not compete.
Right.
So I guess that will all go away as a marketing niche, won't it?
Oh, yeah, I think so.
This has been a long time coming. It's been a struggle to get these kind of changes. So if you look at this objectively, do you think that this is it just a good start, or is it a good regime?
You know, I think overall it's a good regime. I mean, we have to recognize it's still a regime. You know, we're not decontrolling. We're changing the regime. But overall, I think it's very positive. I mean, most people feel it's a very positive change in the sense that it's a regime that lines up really well with, again, you know, what I mentioned earlier of the global dynamics of the space industry, that we needed to have a regime of this nature. There, you know, there are still issues to be worked out, and there are still transaction costs and issues. You know, everyone kind of understood the older regime, stood how to work with it and deal with it, but at the same time, that regime clearly was not doing us any good. You know, it was harming both our economic competitiveness and harming our national security at the same time. So this new regime is better overall in the sense that it's trying to address both of those issues. It's trying to say we can still protect our national security, and at the same time we can enhance our global competitiveness with spacecraft systems, satellite systems worldwide, and we can do both simultaneously without harming one or the other. So from that standpoint, it is a very positive change. You know, but again, having said that, there are still a number of transition issues to work out that haven't been resolved as of yet. So it's still a law that is in the making in terms of its implementation.
What are the types of transition issues that still are out there that people are concerned about?
Well, one of the major ones I did mention earlier, I can highlight it again, is that of the liability shift. Now industry basically has to self-monitor itself and has to engage in self-compliance. So, you know, basically commerce lays out the rules. There's some industry input into that. Those rules are developed, and then the final rules have been issued, and there'll be updates to those rules as we move forward. That is anticipated. But these final rules that were issued, for example, in November of 2014 by commerce are now rules that industry has to live by. So industry number one has to figure out, okay, how do we implement those rules? What do those rules mean for the development of our systems, for the development of our satellite components? And then further, industry has to figure out, well, what is the system we're going to put into place to ensure that we can comply with these rules, and what is the system in place that we need to put forward to make sure that we can monitor that compliance? Because both the monitoring and the compliance now is borne by industry. And that's a sea change. Prior to this regime, this change that just occurred, under the ITAR regime, both monitoring and compliance were borne by government. So government monitors, government compliance officials would make sure that industry was following through. But now it's up to industry to do all that, and that is very uncertain how industry is going to do that. There's a lot of discussions going on within industry how best to address all that. So that's one of the major issues that is ongoing right now.
So is there government oversight and enforcement? And how do they do that if they're relying on the industry to police themselves?
Well, that's another issue that's out there as well. I mean, it's, you know, the government itself has some top-level monitoring of what's going on, but it's largely up to industry to provide the government the monitoring and to provide the government and to demonstrate to government that we are in fact complying with the rules. Now, having said all that, clearly the government wants to see that compliance. They want to see that monitoring, so it's up to industry to demonstrate that sufficiently to government. But therein, there is that transaction issue. There is that uncertainty of, well, how do we need to monitor? How do we need to comply to make sure the government's going to be satisfied? And people haven't figured that out yet. So there's still discussions and dialogue going on between, like, folks at Commerce and industry to better understand, you know, what would be the overall standards that government would like to see in terms of this self-monitoring, self-compliance.
So it'll sound like, to many, a free pass to do what you want.
Well, to an extent, you know, again, many emphasize that it's not freedom from export controls. Again, it's they're still being regulated, but in a sense, you know, you are kind of right. It's almost like I got the sense it's an honor system in a way. You know, we're going to shift the liability to industry to make sure they comply and they self-monitor. So they have to do their self-compliance and their self-monitoring. And we'll just trust that industry is going to do that, And we may or may not catch the violators, but if we catch a violator, then, you know, they will you know, have the penalties and enforcement by government as a result of that. But again, yeah, that is an ongoing issue in terms of, can we trust industry to behave in a way that is appropriate with this new regime? And the hope is yes, because, again, the new regime is much more flexible in treating, again, a commercial system as a commercial system. So the hope is that industry will follow through on their liability now to comply and monitor on their own.
So that's a little funny, because you're asking government, which doesn't even know what the word ethics and integrity mean, to trust industry to self-police and regulate themselves and have some ethics and integrity about making sure they do the right thing and then reporting violations. I mean, this got to be a comedy of errors here. I mean, between government and industry, was this done in Colorado, and everybody was, you know, Rocky Mountain High and smoking dope when they were doing it? I mean, come on, nobody trusts the government to do anything, and the government, it's just ridiculous. Yeah. I mean, I don't know. Maybe it's going to work out. I had nothing to do with it, obviously, and I'm learning about it for the first time, and one can only hope it works out. But I don't know. Maybe it'll. It's kind of like the American Bar Association policing lawyers, right? Or the Contractors Board policing contractors, or any of this self-regulation stuff. So,
right. Well, you know, you have to keep in mind that there are still, you know, it's not quite the way you characterize it. I mean, I think you brought up a valid point, but you have to recognize at the same time there are administrative rules to this new regime. So there are compliance rules, there are monitoring rules.
But no one's going to enforce them except themselves. So what, is Lockheed going to turn themselves in and fine them and dock their CEO, you know, $500,000 for doing this? I mean, so, you know, if the government's not and I'm not so sure you want the government as enforcement agency anyway, because, as I said, that, you know, they're not very trustworthy either. But I mean, I don't know. I don't see how. I think it's a free for all, and why even have regulations then? Because I just, I mean, that's how I see it. Maybe some listeners will call in and argue with me, or they'll post comments on the blog. But you know, if you have two really raunchy groups sort of enforcing on each other some level that neither one of them reaches, I mean, it's just, I don't know, Eligar, it just sounds strange to me. But listen,
it is to an extent, but again, it goes back to I think the premise is that it's an honor system.
There's no honor among
operate in good faith.
There's no honor among thieves. What can I tell you?
Right.
Maybe some people will call in and tell me I'm crazy or I'm being too cynical. The habitual listeners to the show know I'm really cynical about all of this with government and the large corporations. So I just can't see them policing and self-regulating themselves. But listeners, I hope some of you will email in your comments tonight or give us a call. The toll-free number is 1-866-687-7223. Email drspace@thespaceshow.com. I can see why they would jump at wanting to have this new regime put into place. My God, this is like, you know, go past go and collect $5 million every time you pass go on the monopoly board. This is the way I'm understanding it, this is a cakewalk, because there really is no capability for serious enforcement. Unless I'm missing something.
Yeah, well, that's potentially one of the issues out there. I mean, but you have to recognize at the same time is that under the other regime, there was intrusive monitoring and enforcement.
Yeah, no one's arguing that. This is not.
And industry did not like that. I mean, the cost to industry. And the problem with that the cost for all the monitoring and enforcement by government had to be paid by industry. Under the old regime.
Yeah, everyone knows the old system sucked, okay? It was really bad. So, but we're talking about a totally new system now.
Right.
So they've gone from one extreme of excessive and really anti-competitive regulatory protocols that were really hindering American commerce and American industry to a total free-for-all, because there isn't anybody around that's going to do serious enforcement unless you're not explaining it correctly or I'm misunderstanding it. And I guess it's possible that I'm misunderstanding it.
Well,
or I'm being too cynical, but anyway.
Well, I think to an extent, yeah, I mean, yeah, some of the cynicism there. My sense of it is that the compliance rules are out there. It's up to industry to figure out how to address that. There isn't going to be any intrusive enforcement or monitoring per se, but again, it's up to industry to demonstrate to government, we are in compliance, we are monitoring, here's our system for doing that. They have to document that back to government. So there is the there is the oversight of that. So I would characterize it as a shift from a aggressive monitoring system, aggressive monitoring compliance system, to one of self-monitoring, self-compliance with government oversight. Still is government oversight of the process. It just doesn't get to the level of on-site enforcement as we had before.
Here, I'm going to be bailed out now. We got a caller on the line who's going to come rescue me.
So maybe oversight. Oversight's the right term here. You have congressional oversight of an issue. It's more like commerce is overseeing.
I'm going to be rescued for putting both feet in my mouth. So, hi, caller. Are you here to rescue me, and where are you? Caller, are you there? Oh, wait.
Chicago, and I have an interesting parallel to the quandary with ITAR.
Okay, Dave, go ahead.
Sure. In 1996, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission did a survey of the maintenance practices at commercial nuclear power plants, and it was a terrible picture because the plants were only staying online 70% of the time. So they issued a rule called the maintenance rule. And it said, if you have a critical system or a supporting system to a critical system, you had to do maintenance on it of a specific nature. And if you didn't do that, you got fined. And the industry had to police itself. Sound familiar?
Sounds familiar. What happened?
Actually, the outcome was incredibly positive. Today, the national average is online 94 to 96% of a given year. Nobody takes an emergency shutdown anymore. Maintenance is moved to outages that are specifically scheduled and scoped and basically simulated in software. So in the long haul, it worked. However, we do have our little meetings with our regulators, and sometimes we do get fined because we'll come into a meeting and say, well, we did X, Y, and Z, and they'll go, well, you didn't do A, B, and C. And the regulator is very, very good at nitpicking.
So, are there regulators at all, Eligar, for the new regime?
There still are regulators at Commerce, but again, it's more of an oversight role versus, what you had before through the Department of Defense, where regulators at really were on site, regulating everything that industry was doing, whereas now you have regulators in a sense that they're just ensuring that the documentation that industry is providing to self-police themselves is meeting the compliance rules and standards and monitoring practices the government has put forward. So it's only regulatory from that standpoint, from a self-policing standpoint.
So Dave, the consequences of screwing up in the nuclear industry are so potentially deadly for so many thousands, if not hundreds of thousands or millions of people, it would seem to me that there's a different serious level of concern, not only from industry, which could screw up and get shut down, as well as the regulator officials. But
everyone is painfully aware of what occurred at Three Mile Island.
Yeah, so compare that to commercial satellites. The risk are not they don't
oh, the appro- risk, the,
are,
the
they
risk
don't approach
criteria
it.
Is orders of magnitude different.
Absolutely. So would
so
they be
we
more
have
lax?
To go in and basically every problem we have with a plant has to be documented. That documentation has to be performed by a system engineer, people like myself. That documentation has to be reviewed by the regulator. And sometimes they agree, and sometimes they said, you haven't done enough.
So do you think that it's comparable for the nuclear industry to commercial satellites? Are you able to make a quid pro quo comparison, or is it apples and oranges?
I would say it's applicable because in the long term, and I'm talking 5 to 6 years in the future, you'll have a more streamlined process, and the kind of discussion, I'll say it nicely, discussion between government and industry will work itself out. The only place where all of this kind of bothers me is recently I went to try to hunt down a NASA guide, and I think it was basically because of the subject matter, it was restricted. I was trying to find something on solid rocket motor performance, and I tried looking up the SP, and nowhere on the internet did it exist other than a title. Come to find out, Marshall Space Flight Center had restricted it several years ago. So it's caused, the ITAR thing has caused all kinds of weights, so to speak.
Yeah, there's no doubt that it needed to be seriously reformed. I don't think anybody in their right mind challenges that at all.
Yeah, I agree. Absolutely.
Okay, Dave, thank you for your call in. I appreciate it. How have you been, by the way?
Thank you.
Okay. Talk to you soon.
Thanks again. Goodbye.
Thank you for calling.
Listeners, we're going to take our break. We're a couple of minutes beyond the halfway point. We do answer the phone during the break if you happen to call in, 1-866-687-7223, and email, of course, drspace@thespaceshow.com. So Dave Kettlich has sort of calmed down my skeptical nature a little bit, although I do think the consequences for screw-ups and for doing a bum job of self-monitoring in the nuclear industry are far more substantial than commercial satellites. So, I don't know, maybe they'll take it seriously and self-regulate. We'll see. Everybody stay put. We'll be back with Dr. Sade in 3 minutes.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with the Space Show. Your support of the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support the Space Show button. Your contribution will help the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to the Space Show is tax deductible.
And host of the Space Show, and I would like to share my vision with you for not only this radio program, but for space development. Space should be like any other place we choose to visit, work in, or call our home. It should be just another destination, like Tahiti, Hawaii, or any place available to us right now on Earth. When this vision becomes reality, we will be spacefaring in our culture, our economy, our society, and in our lives. Our world will be vastly improved by countless space-related benefits, transforming our lives both in space and right here on Earth. And the Space Show is helping to make this vision a global reality. And welcome back, everybody. You're listening to part two of the Space Show this evening. Dr. Eligar Sadeh is our guest. We're talking about changes in export control, and we have caller John from Fort Worth on the line with us. Welcome to the show again, John. How are you? What's on your mind for Dr. Sadeh?
Well, I was kind of come to his defense a little bit there from what was going on before the previous caller came in. What you realize is that these companies, particularly those that are involved in the defense aerospace business that have been government contractors at least, have been through a variety of experiences over the past several decades with the government. And a variety of laws and regulations have come in, particularly starting in the 80s. And the result is that there's a tremendous focus in the industry on the personnel in ethics training, ethics hotlines, disciplines on things like not doing anti-competitive practices, training courses on this that are flowed down to people even at my level and lower, like pay grade ones even. I mean, I think the idea that the companies won't take any kind of government involvement in a program like this seriously is probably misguided. At least today. I mean, that'd be my perception. I mean, there's a tremendous focus on that sort of thing.
Well, I hope you're right. I'm not so sure. I mean, some of the companies are more ethical than others. There's no doubt about that. And some of their behaviors are better than others. And then you have the companies that are not well-financed and are startups and don't have the history and the infrastructure that you're talking about, but they're also going to be involved in this.
Right. And that may be where the problems might be more likely to occur, I would tend to think.
I think you raise a good point. I mean, I think because we have a self-policing regime now in place for all this doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to have companies taking advantage of that. I mean, I think there's a large sense of a willingness to work with the government, comply with the rules. I mean, most of these companies are also involved with national security systems and defense systems, and they clearly do not want to risk non-compliance with, some kind of penalty or enforcement action if the government was to catch them that could even harm their business on the national security end or other areas they're involved with. So I think there's willingness among industry to, in fact, comply. And as well, there's the uncertainty out there. How is industry going to comply? I know there's involvement from legal experts and lawyers that, in fact, have practices set up to work with people in the aerospace industry, that they can be hired out to make sure industry is in compliance with all the rules. Because, my sense of it, talking to industry folks, is that industry wants to comply. They just have to figure out what's the best way to do it.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, like I said, I don't. Now there could be a problem. I think, like you say, with some maybe companies that are new or smaller and don't have the infrastructure for that kind of thing. Because this sort of process, I think, built over the decades because of various cases. Not just due to ITAR alone, but also issues involving Foreign Corrupt Practices Act violations and things like that have led to severe penalties, termination of many employees and things of that sort, over those years. So, I mean, I'll just have to say that anything involving government regulations where I've worked, in the companies, have been taken quite seriously. I mean, but I've known of cases been reported where some things did go wrong, but I think in some of those cases, the government actually approved of it. I think the Norrell thing with China and the guidance system is one big example, right?
But, John, have they been self-policing, or were they government-enforced regulatory compliance?
Well, I think it's a bit of both. I mean, even when you have a government regime, you also have internal controls in order to not be in violation when the government does check up on you. So, I mean, you know, for anything down, even like time charge, for example, just your labor card, they have internal audits to see that people have a work authorizing document, that they actually are authorized to charge that number and so forth, and that kind of thing. Then sometimes the government comes in and does an inspection, themselves. If that I'd give you an example that both. I mean, you have to have internal controls in order to be able to pass the government inspections. So I think the companies are fairly good at that, I think. But now, and if they've committed to it, you know, and if there is some oversight, and if, like you say, if they have the kind of thing that the previous caller discussed, you know, where they have meetings with a government person to explain what they're doing and all that sort of thing, then, you know, I wouldn't laugh at it, is what I'm saying. I think we have to see how it goes, and probably if something goes wrong, the government will probably do a mid-course correction back in the other direction. You know how that goes.
Yeah.
No, I think that's a valid point. You know, as I mentioned earlier, I think it's largely a self-policing oversight regime now that's in place, and I think, you know, industry wants to make sure that they're in compliance, you know, and again, that it doesn't mean government's out of the picture, and you have to keep in mind, you know, and you hinted on that, is that there is discussions going on a continuous basis between industry and the Department of Commerce in regard to this new regime. In fact, one of the sea change issues as well that was raised that we didn't get to is that industry can now offer suggestions directly to the Department of Commerce to, in fact, treat certain technologies maybe in the past were treated under national security regulations to treat those as commerce items. So industry itself can, you know, there's a motivation upon industry to make sure they do self-police correctly, to make sure they have a positive relationship with government, fruitful relationship with government, because it's only going to benefit their interests, their economic competitiveness in the long run. So I think because industry wants to be profitable, they want to be competitive in this global space business, it's in their interest to now self-police themselves in ways to make sure they meet those compliance rules. So I think the incentives are there for most of industry and for most players to do that ethically and with integrity. You know, and again, I think you could have those that are going to violate that and try to exploit that or take advantage of this new regime now and then. But I think by and large, it should work out quite well. You know, that's clearly, I think, what government's anticipating.
Here's another question for you from William in Los Angeles. And William says, often with the old ITAR regime, companies would have entire legal departments to deal with ITAR issues. Will that be done away with under the new regime? Will it be necessary to have committed legal departments to comply?
Well, that's a great question, and the answer to that is no. In fact, many felt that the new regime, although, again, we've begun to characterize it as a self-policing oversight regime, in fact, has with it maybe more administrative burdens. So you will still need to have the legal teams in place to make sure that industry is, in fact, doing their self-policing in the ways that government wants to see that done with their oversight of it. So it doesn't relieve the industry of those administrative legal burdens. In fact, in some ways, many government folks, industry folks, have stated that it complicates it. It makes it maybe more burdensome administratively to an extent than it was in the past. So it's not necessarily going to do away with that, and that's still one of the concerns raised by industry, is that until that's streamlined in a way and figured out, there are potentially high transaction costs that need to be borne by industry. You know, I think in the long run, if they can get through this phase successfully and they can see that the regime is working under this model, then you can maybe streamline that process once you get that self-policing mechanism in place that's going to meet those government demands. But until that takes place, that could take
a year, several years, it's hard to know. There are clearly, you know, transaction costs that, that industry is going to have to bear to get those self-policing, self-compliant, self-monitoring systems in place.
John, do you have any other questions for Eligar?
Well, I guess not. I thought I just wanted to make the comments I did and discuss what I did. But I said it's going to be an interesting experience, I'm sure. I haven't even quite caught the bow wave of the change in training that's probably going to go with this, I suppose. But I'm not that deep into the engineering there, so maybe that's why I haven't heard it yet. But
right.
But thanks a lot.
Thank you, John.
Thank you for your input, John.
Appreciate it. So, listeners, that opens up our toll-free telephone line, if you would like to use it, 1-866-687-7223. And, of course, the email address is drspace, D-R-S-P-A-C-E, at thespaceshow.com. Eligar, for items that stay controlled by the State Department on the munitions list, the traditional ITAR, does anything change there, or is that pretty much the same?
Well, it's a much smaller list. I mean, again, it's very, very specific to certain technologies that would have a direct military use. So, yeah, there is a significant change. You know, again, it's not an all-encompassing regime as it was in a place where it was trying to control all technologies and assumed everything was related to a military application or military use. It's a very targeted regime right now, targeted to a specific set of technologies or satellite components thereof within spacecraft systems.
Now, what about non-satellite, like spacesuits were on the munitions control list, so does that remain on the control list, or is that over at Department of Commerce?
No, that no longer does. The list is a very, very targeted one. You know, it deals with things like radiation-hardened electronics, for example, which still remains on that list because those type of systems, you know, are typically systems you would see on military satellites for military purposes. So it's very, very specific to what was felt to be more, let's just guard, instead of guarding all our jewels, let's just guard our crown jewels, you know, to use kind of a metaphor there. So it's a very, very targeted, specific set of technologies now that have remained on ITAR with everything else basically moving over to, you know, the commerce control regime.
Did the State Department enforcement rules change, or just the list got narrowed?
Well, what changes are the lists? The State Department enforcement rules are still there. The ITAR USML is still there. There's still a small set of technologies that relate to spacecraft systems in that regime. None of that changes. What changes, as you just mentioned, is the list. Now, having said all that, what some of the problems are is that when we try to target specific technologies, you can have advances in certain technologies, and that may pose certain risks for national security. You know, how we address that and how we deal with that was our issues that are being thought of, but how that all plays out is hard to know at this point. But clearly, there is going to be a need for a more formalized, at this point, there isn't one in place, but many of the people involved in this regime change feel that we need to put into place a more formalized process for reviewing export controls, for thinking about the oversight, the self-compliance, the self-monitoring, for examining on an ongoing basis the specific set of technologies that need to be controlled still under ITAR and the munitions list, because that's going to evolve and change over time how that all plays out. I mean, there is, in fact, a working group that's being developed, although it's hard to know if this is going to have any formal authority, called the Space Technologies Working Group, that maybe could play this role. But that's one of the issues that's being raised. That as we implement this new regime change, we need to make sure we have a formalized process to continually oversee the process and to continually adapt the regime as needed, both from a national security technology standpoint and from a standpoint of evolving the self-monitoring, self-compliance regime that's now in place.
Are you individually pleased and happy and content with the way the changes came down?
Well, I think from a broader perspective, yes. I mean, when you get into the nuts and bolts, I think, you know, as we've discussed over the last hour or so, there are many issues that still need to be resolved and played out, and how those will play out is hard to know. But I think in the broader context, if I look at it more strategically, I'm very, very pleased with it, and I think by and large, industry is, government folks are. You know, again, when you have a regime that's completely out of sync with the global dynamics of how you do business and commerce, that is not productive. And I think from a strategic overview, this regime change clearly makes complete sense. And, you know, and clearly we have to change the regime. You know, how you change it, when you get into the nuts and bolts of it, there are still many issues that need to be resolved. But having said all that, everyone recognized, and we've said this a number of times, everyone recognized that we had to change the regime. It was not doing us no good. So again, strategically, it makes sense. Strategically, this was the way to change the regime, at least in terms of thinking about spacecraft systems as dual-use commercial items versus treating all those systems automatically as military systems. But how you make that effective, how you play it out, will self-monitoring, self-policing work? I mean, you know, you were very cynical about it. Will that work as a model? The verdict is still out there. It's the new model. You know, is it going to work effectively for this industry? We still don't know yet. Is it going to address the economic competitiveness issue? You know, probably so, but we don't know yet until we, you know, move more forward in implementation with this new model and new regime.
Eligar, it's been a couple of years since we talked, so let me take some time in the second half of the show and kind of pick your brain. The commercial industry seems to have made, I mean the entrepreneurial side of the commercial industry, seems to have really made a lot of progress and growth over the recent years. How do you see that? Because, you know, it's been a while since we've talked. I'd love to know your thoughts on the emerging commercial industry, the entrepreneurs, the startups, and the kind of the new space part of the commercial industry. How do you see it all happening?
Well, I think what we're seeing today, you know, and I've done some research work in this area as well, I think what we're seeing today is a fundamental sea change there, in that you have the government, I think, encouraging and helping to subsidize from a capital formation standpoint that industry to provide seed capital for that industry. And I think a great example of that is the success we've had with the, you know, NASA's commercial and crew program and the funding, you know, for commercial orbital transportation services and the way that's played out. And we've seen the success now with Space Exploration and Orbital Sciences Corporation and the next version of that, which is going to be dealing with, you know, human, you know, commercial human space transportation to Earth orbit. So I think overall, and I think we've seen a fundamental change there, and that I think the concern in the past that I heard from many in the space community, particularly the entrepreneurial startup community, was that government's a hindrance. You know, their basic view was government should just get out of the way, very libertarian. Any government regulation is not good for what we want to do, you know, by and large. But I think what we've seen is that sea change in government thinking, where the government now has both a policy imperative and at the same time they're translating that at the program and project level to actually encourage this development. And I think NASA's Commercial Crew and Cargo Program, going back to that again, is a prime example of a model that can work very well for this entrepreneurial industry to develop. You know, the reality is, whether we like it or not, is that as much as we like to talk about a global space economy, as much as we like to talk about the future of humanity and commerce and outer space, and all the ideas we have in terms of how to develop commerce and outer space, is that it's very much a market still largely dependent on government. Both government as a customer, and I think as well the willingness of government to fund or subsidize that sector at some level. There's many different models you can pursue, but to fund it and subsidize it to allow it to develop and grow. And I think without that, there just isn't the market dynamics at play to allow that industry to go it alone without again government as a customer and government as a player to make that industry viable.
Yeah, I tend to agree with you on that completely. So you're thinking the public-private partnership model is a big way for the future.
Oh, I think very much so. Yeah, I'm a very strong advocate of.
Actually, we were writing papers on that. How many years ago at North Dakota? What, 8 years ago? Something.
Yeah,
like
yeah,
that?
We did. In fact, publish a paper on that.
That's right.
Yeah. No, and I would very much agree with you. You know, I think the public-private partnership model is really the very fruitful way to move forward on this. I think what we're seeing right now is a government shift. Even at the contracting level, you know, if you want to get into the nuts and bolts of all this, where the traditional model of government acquisitions and government contracting for space systems is beginning to shift to a model of government looking at industry as a commercial partner and saying to industry, well, we have an interest for certain capabilities, certain systems, certain transportation capabilities, Earth orbit. We want you to develop that. We will help you develop that. We will provide you expert knowledge. We will provide you some seed capital to develop that. And then in turn, we will then either lease those systems or commercially purchase those systems at fixed prices from you as a fixed service for you to provide back to government. So we're seeing that change again, not only like with NASA's Commercial Crew and Cargo Program, which has adopted that model, but also in areas like the competitive launch regime and practice is now being put forward by the U.S. Air Force and the Department of Defense in terms of their launching, which largely has been a monopoly held by United Launch Alliance. We're seeing that beginning to change. I mean, space exploration technologies in that marketplace as well. There's what's called the new entrance certification guidelines that the Air Force has put forward that addresses that particular issue. How do we put into place a competitive launch environment for having industry compete for national security payloads and launching those payloads to space. So I think overall we're seeing this sea change occur, you know, in terms of looking at where the government's beginning to look at industry more as a commercial partner versus looking at the industry just as a contractor to government.
Randy sent in an email from Las Vegas, and he said, given your support for public-private partnerships, what are your thoughts on some of these commercial ventures or other kinds of space projects being financed or conducted as an international partnership? Do you support the international partnership programs?
No, I do as well. You know, and again, I think it goes back to what I mentioned earlier. I think, you know, the business of space, whether it's government-to-government, government industry, public-private partnerships, industry to industry, whatever level you look at, I think there's a global dynamic to all those levels. And I think trying to ignore that is ignoring the reality of the business of space. So I think international partnerships are very much here to stay. And I think we've seen a number of these occur, you know, multinational partnerships at the industry level and multinational partnerships at the government level. I think today it'd be almost unimaginable to think about any large-scale space initiative without having international partnerships in mind. You know, the models you choose, how you implement those, again, that can take a wide that can vary quite greatly from one program or project to another, but thinking about doing something at a large scale without some degree of international partnering or international markets is almost unimaginable today. You're just not going to be successful because, again, the business of space is a very global endeavor.
And I guess then if you're on the satellite side of things, an international partnership has just been made a lot easier.
Oh, I think so, yeah, very much so. You know, where now there can be, you know, more open and free discussions. There, you know, the burdens of treating dual-use systems as national security systems or systems with military applications has kind of gone away. So, yeah, it's a much more friendly regime in terms of encouraging international partnerships now to move forward, which is very important, because without that, you're going to erode your own industrial base, you're going to erode your own global competitiveness and your own economic competitiveness. So, you know, again, and that goes back to what we were mentioning at the beginning of the show, that really was the issue, that, you know, after 10 years plus of being in the old regime, we finally realized that all we're really doing, by ignoring the realities of space having a global dynamic to it, is that we are harming our own national interests, both economically and from a national security standpoint. So I think those are so, entangled, to use a term today, that, in other words, our national security, our economic well-being is entirely entangled with a global dynamic, an international dynamic. And to try to separate those issues out is only, going to harm you in the long run.
So I have another email, and I don't know why they're sending emails tonight instead of calling. Okay, Christine is in Salem. She doesn't say Salem where, so take your pick on whichever coast you want Christine to be from. And Chris says, do you at all, Eligar, believe that space is important and essential to the continued future of the United States of America? And if you do believe that, especially on the human spaceflight side, why do you think it's not valued that way by the space policymakers and Congress?
Well, I go into the first part of that question. I think it's a very good question. I think, very much so. I think the countries that are going to be successful in the future and that are going to prosper economically in the future and prosper in their overall welfare and even from a national security standpoint are those countries that are going to continue to be spacefaring. I think ultimately our future is very much wrapped up into being a spacefaring nation, a spacefaring species, however you want to view it. So I think those two are very much tied together. Dealing with the second issue, if you want to look specifically to the area of human spaceflight and the need to have humans in space, there is debate on that. I mean, personally, I'm an advocate of human spaceflight and having humans in space, and I think humanity does need to get off this planet to not only better understand our planet and what's going on, but to better understand the environment of space. Many talk about the need for spreading humanity to other planets or planetary systems in the long-term future to ensure the survival of humanity. That ultimately, if we fail to become a multiplanetary species, we're going to fail as a human race, and ultimately that could be our own end and our own demise. So you have that long-term argument, and you're projecting forward hundreds of years, centuries forward. But there is debate. There is debate as to, in a shorter term, if you look out currently to 3 to 5 years, 8 to 10 years, do we have to have in place a human spaceflight program? There is debate on that, because most of the value that we derive from space currently deals with robotic systems, satellite systems. That's where most of the value lies. I mean, there is some value in having humans in space, no doubts about it, but if you look at the economic value and the value in terms of science, know-how, and technology, that's largely derived from robotic systems. So there is that debate out there, whether it's needed or not. But I don't think it's lost upon the fact that there is some, that human spaceflight, I think, has always been in our national interest. I don't think Congress has moved away from that. I mean, keep in mind, you could make the argument that Congress, okay, we terminated the space shuttle, we don't have an immediate alternative to that, but at the same time, you have government funding for a commercial crew program. There just was a down select recently of space exploration technologies and Boeing to develop commercial crew capability that can be used by the government, can be used for commercial purposes. So the government is trying to do it in other ways. We were talking earlier, how the government is still pursuing a human spaceflight program. It's funding a new space launch system called the SLS.
that NASA is moving forward on. It's developed an Orion spacecraft that's going to have human capability that just undertook a successful unmanned test flight this past November. So the government is moving forward with a space system development. Whether we'll get to full-scale development of that remains to be seen, but right now I know the space launch system is in its implementation stage. It's moved past its formulation. The Orion spacecraft is in a test stage, so clearly we've moved forward quite a bit in this area. So I think it's unfair to say that Congress doesn't have an interest in human spaceflight. There is a commitment to the International Space Station. Congress is funding, monies for that to keep that operating. We have approved at the congressional and presidential levels, laws allowing us to transfer money to Russia to make sure our astronauts can be transported on a Soyuz spacecraft. The intent is, and hopefully within several years, to use this commercial capability to transport our astronauts. So I think the interest, although there is debate on the value of human spaceflight in the short to near term, I think that there still is a political commitment to human spaceflight.
But the listener, who I'm taking is a space advocate, thinks that space is so really important, like most space advocates do. Why doesn't Congress, or why don't the American people see what the advocates see and, I guess, disproportionately value space as important, instead of an $18 billion budget, throw $36 billion at it or something like that? I think that's what she's getting after.
Well, so, that's...
Because we tend to value the importance of space, either we're delusional or we're over-exaggerating the importance and the value relative to how Congress and other people in the country see space.
Yeah, and I think that that's an issue always raised by space advocates, but I think you have to kind of look at the larger context of this. I mean, right now, and you can look at it from I think, two perspectives. One perspective is that, well, first of all, the government is investing about $60 billion a year on space. I mean, about 18 of it is to NASA, but there still is about another $30 billion plus that's being invested on
space. To military,
the majority of that being the military, about $25, $26 billion to the military, and then several billion spread across other agencies like NOAA and the Department of Energy for some research and things like of that nature.
Right.
So overall, the government is investing about $60 billion. And on top of that, estimates, depending on how you calculate it, if you begin to look at all the value-added services like, communication satellite services and direct television broadcasting services, if you take into account the best numbers you can try to get out of what we would call a space economy or space business, you're looking at probably another $200 billion or so. Which is, it's not a multi-trillion dollar industry yet, but it's a fairly sizable industry. Now, you have to kind of put it in the right context. Again, I think one of the issues out there is that it's still only a couple hundred billion dollar industry. It's not a multi-trillion dollar industry as of yet, the space industry. So I think that's one of the reasons why maybe we don't see more funding from government overall for these things. There's also the mindset among government that let's encourage the private sector, let's encourage entrepreneurial development, let's partner with industry in a commercial way, which I talked about earlier. So I think that's also part of the thinking, is that if we do this, we don't need to invest as much because industry is going to have their own investments, like a co-investment model. And I think the commercial crew and cargo program is very indicative of that. The government is investing hundreds of millions of dollars on an annual basis, but at the same time, industry is investing that as well. You're seeing a co-investment model at play where a lot of that is being shared by the private sector for the development of systems that can be used both for government purposes and commercial purposes. So yeah, I think if you look at it in a context in that way, I think you can begin to understand where the political priority lies and why space gets funded as it does get funded. At another perspective to this, space is just not, when you compare it to other endeavors,
out there. It just doesn't have the same pervasiveness at the societal level that I think other things we do from an economic standpoint have. You know, part of it deals with economics of space not being a multi-trillion dollar industry. Part of it deals with the fact that those involved in space are largely engineers and scientists. You don't have a very diverse community in a space world. So I think as that begins to change, and as we move into the future, as it emerges maybe several decades forward into a multi-trillion, into a multi-trillion dollar industry, as it emerges into other fields and other endeavors from a societal perspective, I think then we'll begin to see maybe a change in how we prioritize, funding for space at the government level.
It's an interesting way of looking at it.
Yeah, just some perspectives there. I mean, I guess you could look at it from many different ways.
We're at the hour and a half point. What should we have talked about, or what has been forgotten, or what else did you want to make sure we knew about tonight?
I don't know if there's anything else, specifically. I mean, we covered quite a bit of ground. Overall, just, maybe finishing where we began in terms of export controls and that. As I said, overall, I think the intent of this change in the regime was to have a regime that's much more friendly and conducive to allowing global space business to prosper, and I think that's very, very important. I think it relates in many ways directly to what we talked about towards the end here of our discussion, in that if you want to have space become more important, if you want to make sure that space fundamentally is changing the way humanity moves forward, that's all inherently linked to having a healthy marketplace for international partnerships, having robust global space business in place, and now we have a export control regime that is incentivizing that to take place, at least from a perspective of the U.S. involvement, the U.S. still being largely a hegemon in this area. So, without the U.S. involvement in this, it's just not going to take place. So I think you have an interesting alignment now with the new regime, although you have all the issues to be worked out, as we've discussed, of a new regime that is in line with allowing for a global space economy to really move forward, potentially to accelerate that, potentially getting us to a point of it transitioning much sooner into, a several hundred billion dollar industry to a multi-trillion dollar industry.
Well, hopefully you're right, and it does grow like that, and grow fast. We will see, right?
Yeah, we will see. Who knows? I mean, hopefully hopefully we'll move forward in the right directions here, and I think it's an interesting time. It's a very, very interesting time, and I think as well we didn't get to this, but I think we're on the verge of potentially having privatized initiatives at the large scale occur, such as, potentially privatized efforts at taking humans to Mars. I mean, space exploration technology is talking about this. You have things like the Mars One initiative, and I think it's very, very interesting. I think government is no longer necessarily the dominant player, although an important player. I think you have this privatization that's going on, which is a very interesting dynamic, where you have now people who are real business people who know how to make money, who've made money in other areas, that have a passion about space and a passion about, taking systems to space, taking humanity to space, that are following through on those initiatives. I think space exploration technologies is the best example of that we have today, but there are clearly others on the horizon of doing things similar to space exploration technologies in different, areas.
Okay. It's going to be an interesting couple of years, isn't it?
Yeah, probably more than a couple of years, but we'll see how things play out in the next, at least while we're still alive, in the next decade or two, I guess.
We better still be alive. You know, that's for sure. Do you think this is this progress is going to be interfered with in any way by coming elections, by changes in political party, or do you think space will sort of continue to be bipartisan and on some sort of an even keel toward growth and prosperity?
Yeah, I think by and large, you know, all the studies and assessments have shown that space, by and large, has been a very solid bipartisan issue. So I don't necessarily see it getting sidetracked in any way by political ideology or political preferences because you have the bipartisanship in place. I think other issues could potentially sidetrack it, you know, the divergences we have with, you know, our national security, global war on terrorism, you know, the list can go on and on, dealing with global environmental issues. But there are other potential calamities that can take us away from paying enough attention to this area, further eroding political support and prioritization of dealing with funding for space or putting forward programs or projects. But, you know, minus something at that level, I think from a political standpoint, it really doesn't matter almost who's in power. You know, you're going to have the bipartisanship in place. You know, there can be differences on the margins, you know, in terms of the policies and what are the ways forward, best ways forward. But I think some of the models we see are going to be supported by both parties in this country, such as, you know, the public-private partnerships we mentioned, which is a new way of doing space business between government and industry, which I think is going to be very fruitful. And it's already borne a great deal of success, you know, with NASA's Commercial Crew and Cargo program.
Absolutely. Eligar, I don't remember the last time you were on the show, but we will have to make a point to talk more freely, more frequently, and stay in touch.
Yes, definitely. Yeah, I know it's been a while, but it was good to come back again.
Absolutely. And are you going to continue doing things with, you know, the export control issues, or have you moved on?
Well, actually, I'm going to be doing one other thing with it. Right now, I am putting forward I'm trying to organize a special issue of Astropolitics. You mentioned at the beginning of the show, the editor of Astropolitics, which is a academic research journal really looking at all space issues, you know, dealing more with the political, strategic, economic, social, legal aspects, commercial aspects of looking at space. But I am going to be organizing a special issue on export controls that will be published in the journal. So that's some additional work I'll be doing on this. So many of the issues we talked about today, I'm trying to recruit government industry, research input, academic input into developing some research articles and reports dealing with many of the issues we discussed today on export controls.
Well, that might be interesting to get some of the people you recruit on the show and talk about, you know, more specialized areas that they will be writing about in the issue. That issue is still not available widely on the newsstands, is it? I mean, they make it hard to get for people, right?
Well, it's accessible. Again, you know, it's not a... You can subscribe to the journal. There's actually a personal subscription. I think it's somewhat affordable. I think it's $100 and some for a personal subscription. Again, there are other ways around that. One way is you can just buy, if you go to the website of the journal, if you just Google Astropolitics, you'll find it. If you go to the website of the journal, you can buy articles online. So if you don't want to subscribe and say, look, I'm not interested in all the articles, but there might be an article in an issue here and there that interests me, you can go to the website and then just purchase that article right online. I think it's, I don't know, 10 or 15, I can't remember the exact price, like per article.
But you can't go to Barnes & Noble and buy a specific issue, can you?
No, you can't. Wouldn't be available. You'd have to go directly to
Taylor
publisher,
Francis,
which is Taylor & Francis,
right.
Rutledge. So you could get it from them. Now, if any listener is interested, you know, if you go to the website and say, hey, here's an article that was published, and I'd like one article sent to me, I can actually send articles to people on a one-time basis. You know, I can't make it a practice of sending out articles and articles to the same person, but if a person is interested in one particular article, I'll be more than happy to send a free copy of that article to a person.
You got an 11th-hour phone call. Do you want to take it?
Sure.
Okay. Hi, caller. Who are you? Where are you?
Tim from Huntsville.
Unbelievable. Do you not listen to the shows and you always call when the show's about to end? I don't get this. You're the only 11th-hour caller in the history of the space show constantly. How do you manage that? This is I should do a show on how you manage that, show after show.
I just thought of a question to ask. I just thought of it.
Okay, Eligar is all yours. Okay. Eligar, this is Tim in Huntsville.
Okay, hello, Tim.
Okay, here's my question. It's kind of a quagmire because of the, you have the small sat people, right? People don't want nanosats. Now, if someone takes a $5,000 nanosat and their orbit crosses and collides with, let's say, a multi-million-dollar satellite, how would that be taken care of? And also, wouldn't that kind of kill the market because, you know, a CompSat company can't take a middle class or upper middle class person to court and get payback for the satellite they lost because they don't have the money.
Well, they might have insurance, Tim.
Right.
They might have third party insurance.
Well, third party insurance is required, first of all. And also you have a legal regime in place as well. You have international space law that would make that you have what's called liability in space. So you have a liability regime where if you could determine who was at fault, which is another question altogether, if you could determine who was at fault, the party at fault then would be liable to pay damages occurred in such a collision. Now, you know, you're dealing with a number of issues. You have the legal regime that states that. You have the issue of how you do space situational awareness. How do you share that data with the commercial sector? There's like a space data association that's been set up now among large-scale commercial satellite providers and operators like Intelsat, for example, and some of the other companies involved in that sector. You have the U.S. Air Force that has the major space situational awareness program, and they inform industry about potential orbital conjunctions or orbital collisions that you referred to. Small sats could potentially be an issue. You know, when we're beginning to look at constellations, particularly of hundreds or thousands of small satellites in space, that could potentially be an issue for all this. You know, how are you going to address that? There are many folks that are discussing maybe to have the need of formalizing a space traffic management system, which we really don't have. We have, you know, space situational awareness being conducted by the Air Force out of a national security interest, them sharing information on a need-to-know basis with industry to avoid orbital collisions. But we do not have in place a more universal, you know, management system of how we deal with space traffic as a whole to avoid those orbital conjunctions. But there is a lot of work going on in this area, tremendous amount of work, tremendous software capabilities, being developed in this area by companies like STK. There are many programs out there trying to address this issue, a lot of discussion going on in this whole area of situational awareness, both for not only the national security area, but also for the commercial area.
Yeah, I'm surprised you haven't got a call from Charles Booley or anything about this. Or is it something that he's already familiar with?
I'm sure he's familiar with it, but he doesn't usually talk about satellite collisions.
Yeah, no, he's familiar with it. I mean, and I think the but the community at large is very, very concerned about this. I mean, both the commercial satellite providers and operators, and clearly the national security community has always had a strong interest in this. But what you're seeing today, what's changed recently over the last, 8 to 10 years has been the willingness of the national security community that has the assets to do space situational awareness effectively, and they gather the data to share that on a need-to-know basis with industry to make sure that we are avoiding orbital collisions. And this is a prioritized issue. I mean, this is a big issue both for the military and both for the commercial satellite providers to have in a place an effective space traffic monitoring system, although it's not formalized at that level, but that's in essence where we're heading to, is to have that monitoring system in place to make sure that we can do our best to avoid those collisions, just like we have, you know, monitoring systems, aviation traffic monitoring systems that are fairly universal and worldwide to avoid aircraft collisions. You know, the same thing, people talk about a similar model being needed to apply to space, and I think in different ways, I think we're moving in that direction. You know, I think eventually we'll have to probably develop a more formalized system for how we do that. But this is a very big issue. You know, there's a whole tremendous amount of political discussions and other discussions going on this area of space situational awareness.
Absolutely.
Yeah, one idea I had was just have a particular orbit set for nanosats and nanosats only. They would go these, I guess, a certain altitude, and they're in this they have an altitude ceiling or some height they can't go above or below.
Right, right. Yeah, and I'm not sure on the specifics of that in relationship to small satellites. I know, for example, you do have that governance with the geosynchronous orbital band with commercial satellite providers, where there is, in fact, a slot, orbital slot designation that's governed by the International Communications Union. And then the member states and member industries to that union have to comply with those slot designations. You have, as well, around larger systems in space, such as larger scale satellites, the International Space Station, they did this with the space shuttle or any human spacecraft. There would be a prohibition in terms of launching anything in the vicinity of those systems in terms of orbital placement. So some of that is going on. I'm not sure how they're addressing it, and I think it's one of these areas of uncertainty still, just like with the export control regimes. I'm not really aware yet of how they're addressing it with the small satellite community that's emerging right now, the small satellite providers, how that's being addressed. But it is a good question. I'm sure, you know, as we move forward on launching these hundreds or thousands of satellite constellations of small satellites, it is an issue that's going to have to definitely be addressed more directly.
Anything else, Tim, or is that it?
No, that's it. Now, I apologize for taking so long, but I just came up with that question, I promise.
Talk to you soon.
Fine. Thank you.
Thank you, Tim.
You're welcome.
Eligar, any other closing comments or anything? Or is that it from you, too?
No, I think we can leave it there. I think I had my closing comments earlier. So.
Okay. Stay in touch, my friend, and if there's any changes on any of this, let me know, and we'll talk about it on air.
Okay. Yeah, no, definitely I'll stay in touch, and maybe we'll try to do something again on the show, maybe in the fall after I come back from the Congress in Jerusalem.
Yeah, that I'd like a rundown on that. And also, if you do get that special issue of Astropolitics put together, getting some of the people on the show might be real interesting. There was something else I was going to ask you, and I've totally lost it. So I guess to heck with that. Listeners, tomorrow night on a John Batchelor Hotel Mars segment, we've got the PI for the Cassini mission and the all of what's going on with Cassini and the new photography and everything. So that's going to be really interesting tomorrow night on Hotel Mars. And then back again on Friday and Sunday with another space show program. Check the newsletter. Thanks to Eligar Sade for being with us and to all of you who called in and emailed and participated. And everybody have a good rest of the week. And we will talk to you again Friday on the Space Show program. Good night, everybody.
Good night. Thank you.